Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Joseph Brinton, and I'll be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and by Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to visit our website at www.hinckley.utah.edu for more information. The title of today's forum is Diversity and Social Capital, the Need to Increase Diversity in Governance and in Our Professions. And today's guest will be introduced by Christopher A. Simon, the Director of the Master of Public Administration, Political Science Department, the University of Utah. Chris.
First of all, I'd like to say thank you to the Hinckley Institute and to Gender Studies and to the MPA program, as well as the Office of the Vice President of Equity and Diversity for co-sponsoring this event. Dr. Maria Chavez is an associate professor of political science at Pacific Lutheran University, specializing in American government, public policy, administration, and race and politics. She recently completed a successful term as department chair. Born in Northern California, the eldest of four children, Dr. Chavez is the first person in her family to have graduated from college. Professor Chavez earned her BA cum laude from Cal State University Chico College of Social Science in 1992, her MA with distinction from Cal State Chico in Political Science in 1995, and her PhD in Political Science from Washington State University in 2002. Prior to accepting her academic post at Pacific Lutheran University, Professor Chavez held assistant professorships in political science at Boise State University and Seattle University. Dr. Chavez teaches government and public policy, American government, political parties and elections, state and local government, U.S. citizenship, and ethnic relations and Latino politics. She has published peer-reviewed articles in the American Bar Association Journal in October of 2011, Social Science Quarterly, Latino Studies, Bar News, and three book chapters published in the following books, Governing Washington, Politics and Government in the Evergreen State, Black and Latino-Latina Politics, Issues in Political Development in the United States, and Latinos and Political Participation in the New Millennium, which was published in 2004. She blogs on racismreview.com, having been a regular contributor since 2010, with 17 blogs to date. Dr. Chavez has also published editorials about immigration in local newspapers, including the Seattle Times. She is the author of the book Everyday Injustice, Latino Professionals and Racism, which was published in 2011 by Roman and Littlefield Publishers. Her monograph takes an in-depth look at Latino lawyers' connection to their profession and community, weaving personal stories, interviews, survey research data, and focus group data into her book. The book examines racial framing in America, the role of language and culture among Latino professionals, Latinos in the workplace, their level of civic participation, the challenges faced by Latinas, and the important issue and role of education in improving the lives of all Latinos. Her book has been favorably reviewed by the esteemed law professor Eli Ward. Dr. Chavez is currently working on a new book, a contract with Paradigm Publishers, and the book is forthcoming in August 2013. And she's co-authoring that, I should say, with Dr. Jessica Lavrega Monforte and Dr. Melissa Michelson. And the book is tentatively titled Mexican Born, American Raised: America's Abandoned Latino Youth. The book will investigate the political, civic, and social experiences of undocumented youth in the United States, and I would add a very timely topic. Among her academic laurels, Dr. Chavez was awarded the K.T. Tang Faculty Excellent Award in Research at Pacific Lutheran University in 2011. She has served as a fellow for the Tomas Rivera Policy Institute. She is particularly proud of her opportunity to interview former American Bar Association President Steve Zak. If you don't know, Mr. Zak is the first Latino to hold this title in the history of the ABA. She has received grants from Pacific Lutheran's Regency Advancement Award, and she did not collect that award. The American Political Science Association Fund for Latino Scholarship, and the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare. She is also the recipient of the Washington State Hispanic Chamber of Commerce Award. Without further ado, please welcome Maria Chavez.
Thank you for that really nice, very long introduction. I'd also like to thank the Hinckley Institute of Politics, the MPA program, Gender Studies, the Office of Vice President for Equity and Diversity, and the Utah Nonprofits Association, and especially my good friend and colleague, Christopher Simon, for inviting me to speak with you today. Also, I just have to say, my sister and her boyfriend, Celia and Art, drove all the way from Chico, California to hear this, and as soon as this is over, they're driving all the way back and getting home at midnight. So I have to thank them, too, for their support. It means a lot to me, even if it's crazy, because they're going to have a long day. And when I told her the topic, she said, fun. So she's a huge support. I'd like to begin with a quote from anthropologist Margaret Mead. She says, if one cannot state a matter clearly enough so that even an intelligent 12-year-old can understand it, one should remain in the cloistered walls of the university until one gets a better grasp of one's subject matter. So I think that's the spirit I would like to speak with you today in. And it just so happens to be Constitution Week in the United States. Yesterday, September 17th, marked the 225th anniversary of the Constitution. So this is a time when we get to reflect on who we are as a nation and what our values are. Or that's what it's supposed to be, but really universities have to do it because or else they won't get federal money. But this is a good time to reflect on our values as a nation and on how those values have evolved in ways to broaden our understanding of justice, equity, and freedom. I can't think of a better venue to do that than the Hinckley Institute, so I'm very grateful to be here. So I'd like to share some of my thoughts on a complicated and important matter that affects us all, namely how to strengthen and expand upon our representative democracy in a society that is increasingly diverse and, some would argue, increasingly divided. So it's my hope that my comments will help us all to think more critically about how we should remain democratic, just, and equitable in spirit and deed, while our institutions of government and our professions are failing to keep up with the changing demographics. So as you heard, the title of my talk today is Diversity and Social Capital, the Need to Increase Diversity in Governance and in Our Professions. The key questions underlying my talk today are these. Does diversity in governance and in our professions strengthen society by increasing social capital and broadening civic engagement? In other words, are there empirical benefits to having representation of as many groups as possible in key political, civic, and economic decision-making environments? Conversely, what are the costs to society of the failure to include diverse groups in these same arenas? Before discussing my views derived from my own research and that of scholars working in this area, it's important let's examine why diversity promotion matters to begin with. So let's start with some demographic information. According to predictions by U.S. Census Bureau demographers, by 2050, well within the lifetime of many of you here, the United States will no longer be a society made up primarily of European descendants. Instead, half the population will be of African, Asian, Latino, or Native American ancestry, making America a truly diverse, globally connected society. So what are the implications of this change on our institutions of power and on democracy? Why does having diverse perspectives in government and civil society and in our professions even matter? Well, we all know that our personal background, our upbringing, and experiences make a difference to our outlook and perspective. Take age, for example. Age makes a public policy preference difference. You can see that in policies such as marijuana legalization. You can see that in policies like gay marriage. Even in healthcare, younger people support healthcare reform to a greater extent than older people. So age makes a difference. So take another example. Here's an example from academia from one of my colleagues. She states in her book and stats, in a diverse society stratified by race, ethnicity, class, and gender, less partial and distorted explanations of social relations tend to result when researchers, research participants, and the research process itself reflects diversity. Such diversity shapes the research questions we ask and how we observe and interpret our findings and the conclusions we draw. So it makes a difference even to what we investigate. I know this to be true of higher education professionally and personally. My position as a Latina professional from a farm worker immigrant background is one of the reasons I'm able to conduct focus groups among undocumented workers, among farm workers, migrant seasonal farm workers, lawyers, jurists, including interviewing, as Professor Simon said, the first American Bar Association Latino professional, Latino president. So a similar demonstration of how diversity matters can be found in the medical research, an area where the University of Utah most certainly stands out for its excellence and international reputation. Here, an article in the American Journal of Public Health in October of 1994 entitled Gynecologist Sex Clinical Beliefs and Hysterectomy Rates. And the authors found that male gynecologists performed 60% more hysterectomies than female gynecologists. 60% more. That's huge. So you know our background makes a difference, right? That's a lot. Another study cited in the article carries the title, Rate of Hysterectomy is Lower Among Female Doctors and Lawyers' Wives. This says it all. It's huge. So women doctors likely, they don't want to be sued. Women doctors likely perform fewer hysterectomies in part because, in addition to their medical training, they have some personal experience as well. And that goes along with their medical knowledge. One final example, let us look at a simple exchange among children. This is also quoted in my colleague's statistics book. And it's called How Culture May Influence How We Count. So this is the example she uses in her book, taken from second graders. A second grade teacher posed this question to the class. There are four blackbirds sitting in a tree. You take a slingshot and shoot one of them. How many are left? Three, answered the 7-year-old of European descent with certainty. One subtracted from four leaves three. Zero, answered the 7-year-old African-American with equal certainty. If you shoot one bird, the other ones will fly away. So all these examples, ranging from the profound to the mundane, illustrate how diversity makes a difference in outlook and perspective, which ends up affecting societal outcomes, especially in the aggregate. I'm not suggesting that all circumstances some come from a particular group are more in tune to the needs of that group who may not, or versus someone who isn't of that background. But I think overall it can make a critical difference. And in our increasingly diverse society, we must at least explore the possibility that our political, civic, and professional circles will be affected by America's demographic changes, positively through effective inclusion, or I argue negatively through continued exclusion. My own research has examined the effects diversity has had on civic engagement and social capital in America. As noted, I've personally interviewed Latinos about their everyday experiences and lives. Based on my research, I've come to believe that it is critically important and most timely that we systematically explore ways to make our governance structures, including our nonprofit sectors and our professions, more representative of the population. If we wish the members of our increasingly diverse nation to maintain faith, belief, and trust in the ability of American society to meet the needs of all its citizens and residents, then work in this area must proceed apace with America's changing demographics. Parallel to the increasing diversity of American society, an evolution of our understanding of governance has taken place. In recent years, this evolution has been quite dramatic. After decades of heavy emphasis on either government initiatives or reliance upon private sector solutions, we've arrived at a much broader meaning of governance, which involves the full range of possibilities, from government-led initiatives to public and private partnerships to broadly based collaborative undertakings to heavy reliance upon nonprofit and faith-based organizations, to the use of economic incentives to achieve the co-production of public goods through millions of individual lifestyle and marketplace choices. Given the demographic changes in American society, I believe the more diverse communities that can be represented in these conversations, the stronger our nation becomes. Along with our greater sophistication of thought on governance, one consideration remains central, namely the continued legitimacy of the government process and the outcomes it produces required by a representative governance process and equitable outcomes as viewed from multiple advantage points. I argue today that if we wish to sustain a healthy civic society, to maintain strong government institutions, and to cultivate continued public faith in our government and private sector institutions and professions, then the concept of descriptive representation should be applied broadly. It should be applied not only to our politically elected representatives, but especially to our public career service, the nonprofit sector, and corporate management and directing boards of the private sector, and to those in professions with highly visible roles and public roles like lawyers. Indeed, because our government representatives are far from being representative of our changing society, it becomes all the more important for these other sectors to do so. My belief that we should heed the words of many scholars, along with Churchill, that argues democracy is a difficult and cumbersome form of government, but one that does feature the potential of maximum attainment of both freedom of thought and action and attainment of equitable and just treatment of its citizens. The attainment of that potential requires, however, that we as people work continuously to improve our democracy and build upon and enhance the elements of our civil society. As long as the people we see making, implementing, and enforcing our laws are overwhelmingly of one demographic type, and the people we see picking our produce, collecting our garbage, mowing our lawns, tending to our aged, working in the nail salons, and filling our jails and prisons are predominantly of others, then our work of sustaining American democratic life is not done. As a side note, my comments today are very prescriptive, and that often makes academics uncomfortable, especially in political science, where the focus is on the distinction between what is and what ought to be, or the facts value perspective, and we follow the professional norms that social scientists should remain skeptical, neutral, objective observers, dispassionate, who just report our findings. And this position definitely has its place in the profession. Maybe it's even the most important role in the profession. But there's clearly room for other roles in the political science discipline as well. In his book, The Essentials of Political Analysis, Philip Pollack argues, to the extent that a value judgment is based on empirical evidence, political analysis can affect opinions by shaping the reasons for holding them. Eugene Meehan takes this point further by arguing that given the scarce resources devoted to the social sciences, it is perhaps somewhat irresponsible to pursue work that does not contribute knowledge that might improve human well-being. So in line with Pollack and Meehan, I believe there is a role for making value judgments based on empirical evidence. And I believe, especially during Constitution Week, that we are wise to reflect on past and contemporary notions of we the people and ask ourselves what work we have left to do to truly create a more inclusive and just society. I hope my comments, combined with America's remarkable and persistent faith in progress and innovation, help us to effectively explore the ways that we can all use our positions to expand on notions of we the people in contemporary American society. So the political and social incorporation of people of color is a difficult task, one that has posed serious challenges throughout American history. Even though the U.S. is indeed a nation of immigrants, most immigrant groups have historically struggled for acceptance and inclusion in America, particularly non-white immigrants. For example, one example I was trying to think of is when my dad did come to the U.S. In his teens, he actually did try to go to school. But because he couldn't speak English, he was put in the back of the room and pretty much ignored. So, I mean, in a community with many needs and in a family with many needs, why bother? He just quit and went to work. And he's not the only one that's happened to. So there are many challenges for acceptance and inclusion for people who are not, for non-whites. The research supports it. In Civic Ideals, Roger Smith argues that a fundamental aspect of the nation-building process is defining citizenship by deciding who will be allowed to become full and equal members of the political community. Smith demonstrates that the history of U.S. inclusion of racial and ethnic groups, particularly through citizenship policies. I teach race and citizenship, and if you just look at the citizenship laws, you can see the exclusion that's been around particularly for people of color. They've reflected racial and gender hierarchies just as much, if not more, than it's reflected liberal and Republican traditions. Inclusion in America has never been easily achieved for diverse groups. As Joe Fagan reminds us, we're just 48 years removed from legalized racism. As a consequence, we're still living with the residual impact of these past institutional policies and practices, including segregated living conditions, lack of political representation, and lack of diversity in the professions. Making this even harder still is the backdrop of economic inequality that continues to worsen in America today. There are many studies that suggest that class, as well as ethnicity and race, contribute to decreased trust, lack of political participation, and limits to upward mobility. Political columnist David Brooks of the New York Times recently wrote an article entitled "The Opportunity Gap." Citing new research from Harvard's Robert Putnam, Brooks examines the inequality of opportunities among children today, which predicts an America more divided by class in the future than ever before. The research findings reported by Putnam show that over the last 3 decades, affluent parents spend more time and money than do working class parents on their children on enrichment activities such as tutoring and extracurricular activities such as music and sports. And it's not just a little difference. The difference is huge. For example, affluent families spend about $5,300 a year on enrichment activities for their children compared to $480 per year of less affluent parents. Brooks quotes Robert Putnam stating, "It's perfectly understandable that kids from working class backgrounds have become cynical and even paranoid, for virtually all our major institutions have failed them, families, friends, schools, churches, and community. If we do not wish for a society that is inequitable and divided, Brooks has this message for us." Brooks states, "Equal opportunity, once core to the nation's identity, is now a tertiary concern. If America really wants to change that, if a country wants to take advantage of all its human capital, rather than just the most privileged two-thirds of it, then people are going to have to make some pretty uncomfortable decisions." So what are these uncomfortable policy decisions? Brooks continues, "Liberals are going to have to be willing to champion norms that say marriage should come before child raising and be morally tough about it. Conservatives are going to have to be willing to accept tax increases or benefit cuts so that more people can spend more money can be spent on the earned income tax credit and other programs that benefits the working class." Brooks also adds, "Political candidates will have to spend less time trying to exploit class divisions and more time trying to remedy them." That's not being done in the latest discussion. "Less time calling their opponents out of touch elitist and more time coming up with agendas that comprehensively address the problem." Brooks adds, "It's politically tough to do that, but the alternative is national suicide." Derek Muhammad, a research associate for the Program on Inequality and the Common Good for the Institute of Policy Studies, a research institute dedicated to the strength of healthy democratic societies, recently wrote a report entitled "The Unrealized American Dream," which highlights some disturbing trends, and I'll just mention a few of them. The wealth gap and all that that entails between black and white Americans will take, according to this study, 634 years to close. Inequality in college graduation rates between blacks and whites will be with us until 2087. And it will take over a century to end poverty for black and Latino children. 30% of black and Latino children live in poverty. Another equally disturbing statistic from another area. In a recent ranking of the best and worst G20 countries to be born female by Trust Law, a global poll of experts which ranks the world's major economies in terms of how good they are for women, the U.S. ranks 6th out of the G20. By the way, Canada ranks 1 and Mexico ranks 15. I should move to Canada. But anyway, the reasons for our 6th place are because, quote, "Many of the gains of the last 100 years for women are under attack, and the most overt and vicious attack is on reproductive rights. Women also suffer disproportionately from the lack of affordable health care." So these are all important dilemmas that government, the nonprofit sector, and the professions will have to grapple with if they hope to sustain a healthy civic society, if they hope to maintain strong government institutions, and if they hope to cultivate public faith and legitimacy. As social scientists and professionals, it's our responsibility to use our position of relative privilege to work towards improving our society and strengthening our democracy. As another side note, I do blog for Racism Review, even though I've kind of stopped because you just put yourself out there like a target. This isn't about excluding the white guy. It's about welcoming excluded groups. Diversity is additive, not subtractive. Inclusion makes us all stronger, richer, and more democratic. And my goal in my teaching and research is to strive for knowledge that leads to increasing harmony and diversity in society. So this is for my preview. First, I'll talk about some relevant definitions grounded in public administration and public policy foundational ideas. Then I'll discuss what social capital is and civic engagement, and then focus a little bit on my study on Latino lawyers and migrant seasonal farm workers. Then I'll talk about the importance of representative democracy at the state government level, focused on Washington, but it could be Utah as well, because Latinos are now the largest minority group here in Utah as well. And then finally, I'll conclude by offering some thoughts on how to improve diversity by focusing on the combination of institutional change and personal change through a steadfast commitment to diversity and engaging the issues with civility. I think that's important. So what do I mean by diversity? Ellen Schell, Dean of the Robert F. Wagner Graduate School of Public Service at NYU, made the following insightful observation regarding diversity. Difference matters. We know that race, ethnicity, gender, religion, sexual orientation, national origin, disability status, and many other aspects of personal identity shape the way we see the world, the way our resources are distributed, the way our policies are made, the way our boundaries are drawn, and the way our institutions are managed. Congressional scholars Davidson, Olzick, and Lee note as a follow-up to Ellen, there's no substitute for having a member of one's own group in a position of influence, and many groups do not receive representation commensurate to their presence in the population. So how then are our resources distributed, our policies made, and our institutions managed? When Congress is less than 20% female, less than 10% black, and less than 5% Latino. Again, Davidson et al.'s quote, there's no substitution for having a member of one's own group in a position of influence. So what are we doing? How do we do this? Well, my husband and I have been watching Mad Men on Netflix. Just to put this into perspective, things aren't as bad as they used to be. The show depicts how divided society was a mere 50 years ago. And scenes from Mad Men describe all the isms. Have any of you seen that? Shocking. It's terrible. Humorous, but awful. This is a time when a husband could call his wife's psychiatrist to find out what was said at the session. That would be unthinkable now. Or you could fire the homosexual employee for turning down a client's sexual advances without giving it another thought. Or you can engage in anti-Semitic behavior. There was a scene where there was a Jewish client that they wanted to impress, so they looked for the only Jewish person on staff who was in the mailroom and brought him up and pretended he was an advertising executive. So those are examples to show we've come a long way. We don't find certain things acceptable anymore. But if you look at where we are professionally and in government, we have a long way to go. How about Fortune 500 companies? According to Ziegenhaft and Domhoff, as of 2010, there are only 75 women and people of color leading Fortune 500 companies. So let's compare the representation of those 15 are Latino, and of those, most are from elite families from Latin America. So you almost can't count that, right? Because it's a totally different experience. So again, let's look at some numbers. 63.4% of the U.S., of the country is white. And 50.8%, half, are female. Less than 20%, remember, are representatives in the 112th Congress. 16.7% of the population is Latino. And remember, less than 5% of the representation in Congress is Latino. 13% of the population is black, and it's about 8% in Congress. So 5% is Asian, and there are 3% Asians in Congress. So clearly, neither Congress nor our professions come close to being representative of America's diversity. So what do I mean by diverse representation? There are two principal types, descriptive and substantive. Descriptive refers to having one's ethnic, racial, religious, or sexual orientation represented. And similar to descriptive representation is the concept of representative bureaucracy, which I'm sure most of you are aware of. or some of you are aware of. Substantive representation, on the other hand, means having someone of any background but with the similar commitments to those advocated by the identity group in question. So that's the difference. And just for a little context, before sharing the research that I've done, I'm sure those of you who've had the privilege of taking courses in public policy or public administration from Professor Simon are well aware of this context and these existing theories and framework, but I just wanted to go over it a little bit. George H. Fredrickson, in The Spirit of Public Administration, states that it's the responsibility of the public servant to nurture the development of a virtuous citizenry, and such a citizenry will respect and revere a caring and committed public servant. So it's basically working together. Fredrickson continues, the public means all people coming together for public purposes rather than for personal reasons. The public has a capacity, implies an informed, active ability to work together for the general good. And this sometimes includes government, but sometimes it includes nonprofits, sometimes it includes the private sector. Another founder of the field, Harold Laswell, considered the founder of policy studies, felt strongly that the public policy field must be centrally concerned with improving democracy. And he writes, the ultimate goal of public policy is the realization of human dignity in theory and in fact. So in this regard, I'd like to look at Anne Schneider and Helen Ingram, and look at how they analyze how public policy is made. They basically say politicians will provide policy benefits for advantage groups and policy punishments or burdens for disadvantaged groups. So they explain that politics, culture, socialization, history, and the media, literature, all that contribute to a harmful social construction of some groups, the stigmatization that you were talking about yesterday, and it leads to degenerative policymaking. This is seen in how hard it has been, for example, for Congress to pass the DREAM Act. Orrin Hatch, originally from Utah, originally sponsored that legislation, and he wouldn't sign it in the end. Why? Because it seems as it's a policy benefit for a socially constructed, stigmatized group. So that's why you also see examples like the war on drugs. That's a policy burden or a punishment for a stigmatized group. So that's how public policy is made in many cases. And in the interest of time, I'm going to skip over to some of my research. Basically, it's related to the issues of trust. In 2000, Robert Putnam offered a groundbreaking theory of the decline of modern civil society as a reflection of community social capital. And he defines it as social networks, associated norms of reciprocity, and interpersonal trust. He says that social capital enhances the ability of communities to work together to solve problems. In the same way, Fredrickson describes what's done in the spirit of public administration, and likewise enhances the effectiveness of government policies. While Putnam's initial work didn't address the social capital of poor communities, subsequent treatment of the topic by a number of scholars has explored that issue. And what my colleagues and I found that missing from this discussion of healthy civil society and social capital are outgroups. So with this in mind, we examined for one of the studies, we looked at migrant seasonal farm workers in Idaho. And we found that among this economically critical group in the agricultural systems here in the American West, trust is really low, obviously. We also found contextual factors such as community diversity and how local government agencies, nonprofits, and faith communities in the surrounding community receives new immigrants makes a huge difference. Robert Putnam has gone back and forth on the issue of minorities and incorporation. He talks about bonding and bridging social capital. So bonding, birds of a feather flock together. And bridging is the kind where diverse groups come together. And that's the best kind to have. But examining outgroups such as immigrants, I think, are the canary in the mines. They're the real measure of how well we're doing with regards to social capital. And based on my research and the research I conducted in Idaho, we thought migrant seasonal farm workers would be very alienated from Anglo society, but very connected to Latino society, the Latino professionals in the area. We were totally wrong. They didn't trust anybody. They didn't trust they had really low trust for Americanos, and they had equally low trust for los Mexicanos que tienen corbatas, you know, the Mexicans that wear ties. So we were totally wrong. co-ethnics didn't matter. So, and that's after surveying 555 migrant seasonal farm workers. They said things like, when we go to the store, Walmart, we see many Mexican Americans. They don't help us, and gabachos, the whites, are more willing to help us. Another focus group went as far as claiming that white people who do not understand Spanish try to assist us and communicate more than Mexican Americans, many who do know Spanish. One said, Mexican Americans make fun of those born in Mexico. Another one said, I don't understand why Mexican Americans who speak Spanish won't talk in Spanish and help us out. Another comment, I was like, oh, don't say that. This hurts. Another one said, the ones that are born here, Mexican Americans, feel superior and treat us like dirt. Another quote, Mexican Americans with one look, they make us feel like dirt and put us to the floor with their superior attitude. I don't understand why Mexican Americans treat us different. We are all the same. So this is a community. I don't know what the undocumented rate here is in Idaho. The study is in Idaho, in Utah. But this is a community that's completely alienated from the larger society and the Mexican-American society. And so that's an important finding. And the next thing that I looked at was Latino attorneys. And basically, I'd like to just mention two points that stigmatization does not end with professional status. That's one of the main things that I found with this study. And I'll talk a little bit about that in more detail when I quote the only and the first Latino Supreme Court justice in Washington State, Stephen Gonzalez. But on the other hand, they do participate. Every other measure is a success. Their income, their professional responsibilities, their civic engagement, they're successful in every sense of the term. Other than the fact that they still experience gatekeepers in many, many arenas because of the stigmatization. But it's also a motivation for why a lot of Latinos went on to law school. Just a couple of personal or a couple of stories from my research. There's that the discrimination became a motivation for them seeking law school. I'll use one example. Anna, who grew up the youngest member of migrant immigrants, and they earned an meager living as farm workers in Burley, Idaho, says that what motivated her to go to law school were all the unpleasant experiences that she saw. She hated that her parents weren't treated fairly when they worked in the fields of sugar, beets, beans, and potatoes. She recounts the grueling, often illegal conditions they endured in the fields, including having to only take 15-minute lunch breaks, not getting bathroom breaks, and her dad was always especially cautious because of the ranchers. She asked me to change that in the book because her dad was so deferential, she said, to the ranchers that she felt humiliated for him. But she didn't let me add that. When I showed her what I was going to write, she said, can you just kind of soften it up and not make my dad seem like he was, you know, so humiliated? But that wasn't easy for her, so that's what motivated her to go on and become a lawyer. And her undergraduate political science professor at Seattle U, that's as far as I'll go, told her she didn't have what it takes to become a lawyer. And in 2009, she won the prestigious pro bono award, usually reserved for attorneys from huge firms, and she's in her own solo practice. And most of the work she does is help undocumented workers collect wages that are owed. So another motivational story for why someone became an attorney was from Tony, who felt, and I really, really hope I changed his name, because, you know, you take notes and you work on this for years and then you forget. These are all supposed to be pseudonames, but I have a nagging suspicion that this isn't. So we'll find out one day if I get sued or something. But feeling wronged is what drove Tony. He's now in his late 50s to become a lawyer. Several of his high school teachers had suggested that he set his sights on something realistic, noting that becoming an auto mechanic might be a good choice for him. And this made him really angry. So he was determined to do something else. And He says, as a Latino or Native American or any other kind of minority, you're just another wetback or you're just another migrant farm worker or whatever until you're a professional, and that suddenly changes your stature. And you have to be aware of it, because whether it's brought out to you or whether you faced it or experienced it, it's there. The whole idea of being a minority and working as a professional, you always have to be outstanding in order to be accepted. So these are the kinds of things that motivated people to go on. Most of the people in my study came from parents who lacked formal education, so they were first-generation college students. Most of the fathers came to the U.S. and worked as manual laborers or blue collars, so they understand at a very personal level how education changes lives. And here's an example from a Latina attorney. I made it to an elite college because I was intellectually curious and knew that an education would open up a world of possibilities for me and would provide me with opportunities and information that my parents had not had. My mother has a fifth-grade education. My father never went to school. I was adventurous and ambitious, and I had no idea that I would be in competition with middle-class and wealthy classmates who've been preparing for elite universities since they were five. I'd never heard of elite prep schools from which my classmates at Yale graduated. I had no idea that high school students actually took courses to improve their SATs. I also had no idea how much money an elite education would cost. She went to Yale for undergrad and Harvard for law school. Paradoxically, my family's poverty worked to my advantage. As a consequence of generous financial aid, which I'll always be grateful for, I was able to graduate from college with no debt. So that's one of the good stories. But there are a lot of other ones where they were, like I said, there's a lot of discrimination still. Again, though, for example, Tony, when I asked about the effects on his life of being a minority, he states, I'm always aware of it, and it's subtle. It's subtle, for example, when I bought my home that overlooks the water. I was outside, and I don't know what I was doing. My neighbor says, oh, are you the gardener? And my actual gardener, who's a 6'3 and a white guy with blonde hair, says, no, I'm the gardener. That's the owner. And the face on the person was like totally changed, and that's what I've experienced for 55 years. So then I asked them survey questions. Like, there was the survey had a two-part question that said, if being a Latino has caused them difficulties in the profession. And here are some examples of what they said. Societal stereotypes are very common in the legal profession. Most people believe you are a clerk, bailiff, or an interpreter. That's one comment. Only to the extent that people of color must be better than others to succeed. I truly believe this. Not a good fit for firm culture. I was not considered a good mix for certain firms. People don't take you seriously. Presumption of incompetence. And those are the kinds of responses that were in there. And as one Latino lawyer stated in the focus group, I think I've given it my best good effort trying to deal with all these white groups, and I give up. I've tried to go here and do this and do that. It's just uncomfortable, and I don't like it. I have business I have to do, so I can go in and eat cheese and crackers like anybody else, a little wine, but I miss that Budweiser with carnitas, and I just want to go in and do my thing and get the hell out of there. I'm tired of that bullshit game where I have to be a white guy. So that's the kind of sense that they had. But if you look at their civic experiences, it's not all, bad. They're really working hard. And out of 101 Latino attorneys in Washington, many of them are in professional positions where they speak English and Spanish at work, where they're doing the bridging that Putnam thinks is so important. Regarding rates of civic engagement, Latino lawyers' rates of participation are 86.9%. The comparison group of white attorneys I surveyed had a really high rate of 80%. So attorneys are a civically engaged group on many fronts. And so just talking a little bit about the importance of representative democracy. Well, I don't have time. I'm going to skip that one, and I'm just going to get to some of my conclusions. Because I really don't have time. So I've talked about the importance of social capital and civic engagement, the importance of diversity. I guess my argument that I'd like to leave you with today is we've come a long way from what was established by the framers 225 years ago in our Constitution. We the people now includes more of us than ever before, but we still have a long way to go to achieve the social and political incorporation of the poor, of immigrants, and of people of color. The principles of establishing justice or the blessings of liberty that are found in the preamble of the Constitution are just as important now as they were when they were written by the framers. And we have to have the wisdom and tenacity to continually seek ways to improve our government and our representation in terms of diversity. And as I stated at the beginning of my remarks to you today, I believe that among our greatest strengths is the belief in progress. As Confucius once stated, it does not matter how slowly you go as long as you do not stop. So during this Constitution Week, I want to conclude by offering some suggestions on what we can do to continue to increase diversity in our governance institutions and professions. I think we need to do it, like I said, institutionally and professionally. Institutionally, it starts with public policy, I think. As my colleague Luis Fraga states, public policy is the primary way in which Americans have always demonstrated their commitments to each other. And what should these commitments be if we want to increase diversity? There are many worthy ideas, but I'd like to focus on increasing educational access as a way to improve diversity, because I've seen from my research that that really works. Similar to the GI Bill, which provided funds, college funds for World War II vets in the 50s, public policies that provide low-debt college education to first-generation and low-income students would truly open the pipeline of diversity at all levels. I believe this could be accomplished by modifying a very unpopular public policy program, namely affirmative action. While it is beyond the scope of this discussion to talk about the pros and cons of affirmative action, and, you know, people are very passionate about their beliefs on the left and the right. The right says it's reverse discrimination. The left, like Michelle Alexander says, it's considered racial bribery. She argues we want to focus on affirmative action to not deal with things like the mass incarceration of men of color especially. So without getting into either side of the debate, the benefits of educational opportunities, I believe, are felt far and wide. They do increase the bridging kind of social capital. And I'm in agreement with political scientist Amy Gutman, who argues for both class-conscious and color-conscious public policies, arguing that both are necessary and neither is sufficient to address diversity. Gutman says, color consciousness faces up to the fact that Americans today are still identified by their color and treated in distinct, often morally indefensible ways by virtue of it. Not to be color conscious is not to face up to this fact. The color of Americans significantly affects their life chances and experience, not for any essentialist reason, but for no less significant historical and social reasons, which no individual is sufficiently powerful to change. But more than this, it's basically about what kind of society we want to have in the future. Do we want to remain segregated by class and by race, and in many cases, by gender? But I believe it also comes at the personal level. As I was saying, we also need to make change at the personal level. As political science students, MPA graduates, administrators, pre-law students, you have an opportunity to be active in the community, to increase social capital, and to increase diversity. By doing so, you will improve our society. If you're so committed, you also have the opportunity to increase diversity in your spheres. It's a delicate and difficult work, but I think you can do it at the personal level through civility. In this month's edition of the Seattle Journal for Social Justice, published by the School of Law at Seattle University, like I said before, the only Latino Supreme Court justice, Stephen Gonzalez, writes, "Civility is a way of connecting and interacting with people, of engaging and thinking about our relationships with one another, of discerning what we care about. It's about how we communicate and how we persuade and convince, because that's often what we're doing in our legal profession, is persuading and convincing. If we've alienated people from the outset, it can be much harder to be effective." Justice Gonzalez then goes on to examine the often uncivil treatment of attorneys of color by using himself as an example. He states, "Let me mention, for example, attorneys of color who are sometimes in criminal cases mistaken for the defendant by the participants. How do we respond to that? Sometimes we are overly formal by making sure that we are dressed particularly well, that our speech is particularly professional, just to let people know who we are, because we're not always given the benefit of the doubt." He says, "I remember when I was a federal prosecutor, I was traveling with my wife to Texas, and we went to the federal courthouse in Laredo, Texas. I was curious. I thought, I'm part of the federal family, so I'm going to go in and see what a different federal courthouse looks like. When I went into the courthouse, I started getting tailed by security. They followed me through the courthouse, and when I walked into a courtroom, the clerk said, 'Defendants, sit to the left.' That was the first thing she said to me as I walked in, and I realized that I was out of my suit. I looked to them like a suspicious person or a defendant in that context. So sometimes in response to that, we get formal. Please understand that people react differently to different contexts and that it goes directly to the point that civility depends on the person, the context, and cultural factors. On so many levels, there cannot be one rigid definition of civility. So I think with that in mind, I'd like to pass out a handout on how to do things in a personal way if you're so engaged to diversity. And here are just some strategies. I'll give you some that I think are helpful for doing it in a civil way. So I think Justice Gonzalez demonstrates that civility is difficult to accomplish in our racially segregated society. We have expectations about certain groups and where they should be. This handout's from the Center for Courage and Renewal. But there are abundant societal benefits to increasing diversity, as Fagan outlines in his concluding chapter of The White Racial Frame. These benefits include economic gains for society as a whole when marginalized groups such as African Americans or Latinos can come out from under the shroud of racism, as he says, and gain much new energy for seeking their broader group and societal goals. Also, democracy would improve when people of color are fully welcomed and included in all of America's institutions, including political and professional ones. Fagan states, all Americans will benefit from the inclusion of new knowledges in the public and private spheres. A great expansion of social and political democracy will make essential knowledge finally available for the long-term development and improvement of what is still very much democracy under construction. It is my hope that we all strive to live in a society that continues to be more inclusive, equitable, and just, as long as we do this with civility, patience, and compassion. And that's not easy, and I say that because I need a lot of it, especially the compassion part. It's not easy for anyone. So I'd like to end with another Margaret Mead quote. I think she's got great quotes. Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. So one person really can and does make a difference. And increasing diversity really does begin one relationship at a time. And the point from the number one in the handout states, friendship is the most powerful diversity strategy there is. I would have never imagined that I, a Mexican-American first-generation college student, would have come into contact with some of the people that I love the most today. If it wasn't for the power of friendship as diversity, I wouldn't have had the opportunity to attend college. If I hadn't had that chance, I would have never met my advisor, mentor, and dear friend who I love like a father and who happens to be from a Croatian immigrant background, Nicholas Loverich. I would have never met my good friend and colleague who asked me to come speak with you today, who is of Armenian and Greek ancestry, Chris Simon. And in graduate school, I met and married my husband, a Canadian who's originally from Swedish background, whose family homesteaded in Saskatoon. And as I told Lena yesterday, I went to their Swedish family reunion, and I was the only one there with brown hair. And next week, I will attend the Seattle Polish Festival with one of my dearest friends. And I could go on and on about how it really does make a difference at the personal level. But the point is, my world opened up in a way it would have never done so had I remained in the deeply divided and segregated Northern California farmworking community where I grew up. It is truly just one person in one relationship at a time that can bring healing and end our divisions so that we can become a happier, stronger, and more united society. And even if you don't agree with my policy prescriptions or my conclusion that increasing descriptive representation is important to the civic health of America, I hope we can at least agree that continued deliberation about how to achieve a more equitable and less divided society is an important task we should undertake as political scientists and public administrators and future attorneys. As Michael Sandel states in his most recent book, What Money Can't Buy, democracy does not require perfect equality, but it does require that citizens share in a common life. What matters is that people of different backgrounds and social positions encounter one another and bump up against one another in the course of everyday life. For this is how we learn to negotiate and abide our differences and how we come to care for the common good. Thank you for your time and attention.
We'll now devote the remainder of our time to questions from the audience. We have about 8 minutes. So if you have a question, please state your name, a little bit about yourself, and speak clearly into the microphone. If I could start off with a question first. My question is, where do you see we've made the most progress in, like you talked about, with the professions and in the institutions, in creating a diverse environment?
Okay, that's, I actually think at the educational institution, which is the pipeline for the other areas, economically, if you look around, have we made progress there? No, not when 30% of Latinos and blacks live in poverty. In representation, if we look at the makeup of the 112th Congress, do we see representation there? No. If we look at state and local government, is there representation? No. So I think the most progress is at academic and educational institutions, because politically, economically, we still have a long way to go. So, yeah. Lena?
Hi, I'm Lena Sudina with the Political Science Department of the MPA program. I was thinking about the challenge of bringing diversity into organizations and into our professions. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how to bridge that gap, the trust gap. You know, I'm a white person mm-hmm. in a predominantly white organization. How do I bridge the trust gap in order to bring more diversity into my own organization?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. And that's kind of why I handed these things out, because... Oh, sure. I don't like that. Okay. You have to be willing to make mistakes with people. Because sometimes you will say things or do things that contribute to the lack of trust that have nothing to do with you, that were already there. Do you see what I'm saying? If someone doesn't trust someone else, it's because of their, you know, if someone, it's because of their many, many experiences perhaps that led to that perspective or that assumption about you. And when it may not be about you, and then get beyond that, it's hard though. It's really hard. I think that's why Justice Gonzalez's statement on civility is so important. Because we will make mistakes with each other, but we can be respectful and civil, and then we can get beyond them. So I don't know if that helps, but anyone else?
My name is Tanya Perez. I'm a LEAP pre-law student. My question is, so last week I went to another speech. It's called the September Project. It was Thomas Norman and, hold on, I'll figure out their name again. But their books is about It's Worse Than It Looks. And so they're talking about how, going back to your topic on Congress, how we need more people and representation. They were talking about how we need back the old Congress, like the problem solvers. We need like how our mm-hmm. former fathers wanted it back. Would you agree with that? And how, you know, as a youth community, like the community, we need to get more involved, especially with the minorities. Or like, what would you suggest for people to get more involved in politics?
Well, the first part about is Congress broken? Absolutely. Ornstein and Mann argue that it has been dysfunctional for a long time. Congress isn't doing the public policy work that is needed by this country. But I don't think that is about going back to making we the people more exclusive. That's not the problem. The continual campaign and the lack of political compromise, and there are a lot of other reasons why Congress isn't working. Getting youth more involved is a great... Well, as you said, it's just so key. Having to have public policies focused on what priorities you have rather would be, you know what I mean? If you're more involved, the public policy priorities should hopefully reflect more of what you are interested in, like access to education, Pell Grants, increased benefits that way. And that's not happening right now. Because this is a demographic that isn't as active, and that's just the way it is. So it is important. I don't know how you would create that fire to get more people active at the national level. I think at the local level it's really important too. I teach state and local government, and I make my students go to 2 legislative meetings at the state and the local level, give them extra bonus points if they actually comment on something that's going on. So I think part of it is not knowing how to do it. Part of it is it's very confusing. Part of it is it's very boring sometimes. So all those things, and part of it is you're so mobile. Your demographic group is very mobile, and so you don't plant roots the way that you know others do, and that makes you less active. But that's I think that's an excellent point. Although Congress does have major problems, I wouldn't say we should go back to the framers' ideas of what Congress should be at all. I'm trying to say the opposite, you know. expand the We the People.
Excuse me. Hi, my name is Bala Ambadi. I'm an ophthalmologist. I had two questions, if I may. First was, in the beginning, you used a study from the American Journal of Public Health to build the foundation of your case that background influences policy. So in that study on gynecologist gender and hysterectomy, that was from 1994 in North Carolina, the results indicate that the main factor affecting hysterectomy rate was year of residency graduation when the physician completed training. That was actually the only one that was statistically significant in their research model. Further, male gynecologists had a patient case mix that had more than twice the rate of uterine cancer as female gynecologists did.
Well, so, let me stop you real quick. Do you think then that's because traditionally males, male gynecologists have been in the profession for longer and have bigger caseloads, and that affected it? Or?
So in the study, it says that male gynecologists finished residency. They were older on average. I think there was a decade of difference. And so their residency training was more antiquated, if you will. And further, that you know, they had double the number of cancer patients that female gynecologists did. I don't know why that is, but that was what they showed. So my question is, you know, when we build cases based on headline statistics, can we dive deeper into those to show a more nuanced and root cause factor of what's actually going on? That's my first question. And second question, your own research showed that migrant workers had as many issues with Mexican Americans as they did with Caucasian Americans, if not more, you know, from what you
described. There was a sense of betrayal, yes.
Right. So in that context, would it not serve our country better to not focus so much on identity politics and dividing people by what label they put in front of their American name, but just rather focus on building better Americans by bringing people together on building character in civil society rather than dividing people among groups? As a someone who was born in another country, as someone who came with parents from the ground up, and someone who neither benefits from affirmative action nor from traditional bastions of privilege, would it not serve everyone better to focus on helping people become true Americans based on the content of their character, not on their race or gender or anything else? Thank you.
Sure. I'll address your last question first, because that's what's got my heart racing. The definition of a true American has been historically and legally white. If you look at who could become a citizen, you would have been excluded up until, I mean, the Takao Ozawa case, I'm sure people are aware of that. Takao Ozawa was a Japanese American who could not become a citizen because he was Japanese. The Thind case was another case where an Asian American, a person of East Asian ancestry, could not become an American because he was not Caucasian. And the Supreme Court said they knew what a true American was because they could. That was a person of Caucasian ancestry. So I don't think identity politics is something we've developed, and what a true American has historically, for two-thirds of American history, according to Roger Smith, excluded non-whites. So if we want to take an ahistorical perspective, then yes, we can say, why don't we quit all this identity politics stuff? Well, nobody wants to get over the identity politics and race stuff more than people of color in terms of being excluded, because that's often not a benefit. It's a burden. Your first point, yeah, absolutely. I don't know the medical literature. I don't know. I mean, you could probably dissect that much better than I could. That was just one of many examples to show that perspective, background, personal experience can make a difference. Next time I'll use a better example. I'm sure I could find them. So the scientific, the medical scientific literature is, I think it makes a difference. I personally like to go to my female nurse practitioner because I think she understands my position and what I want more than a male gynecologist would, for example. So I guess the sense that it's about character is true, but it's also about color, and we can't deny or ignore that. At least we can't if we look at our history in any way. So, any other ones?
Please join with me in thanking Professor Maria Chavez for an excellent and informative forum.